Session number 27055, Reel 1.
Ian Smith, this is a great privilege on my part to interview you on behalf of the Sound Archive for the Imperial War Museum. This is really a tremendous privilege. Could I start, please, by asking you for your full name and your date of birth and where you were born?
So my full name is Ian Douglas Smith. I was born in a place called Siliqui, which in those days was Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe. And I was, what else did you want, the date of my birth?
A date of birth, please, yes.
8/4/19.
Thank you very much. Can you tell me where you went to school, a little tiny bit about where you went to school and how you grew up in Rhodesia as it then was?
Well, I went to school at Chaplin's School in a place called Wello, which is the hub of the Midlands of Rhodesia, nearer to Bulawayo than to Salisbury. And in those days it was a good thing because Bulawayo was the centre of Rhodesia. It was a much bigger place than Salisbury. The change came about with the advent of Federation, because Salisbury then became the capital of the Federation, and the big copper belt companies from northern Rhodesia, as it was then called, the rich copper belt, they moved down to Salisbury. And that's when Salisbury became a bigger and a stronger place than Bulawayo. Excuse me. But when I went to school there, I think I probably paid more attention to sport than to academics. I was the captain of the cricket team and the captain of the rugby team and the Victor Adorum and the captain of the tennis team and so on. As I say, I was obsessed with sport. That was my life. And that's how I grew up. Excuse me. And when I went to university, Rhodes University in Grahamstown, it was much the same sort of performance.
At that time, of course, that would be 1938-39.
That's right.
The war was pending. To what extent did the darkening international situation in Europe affect you 8,000 miles away? How much did it impinge upon you and your fellows, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds?
Well, I walked out of university to go and join up and fight the war. We weren't supposed to. Our government had said you must finish your degrees first. But I was not prepared to do that. So I just packed my bags and I went. Unfortunately, there was an Empire Air Training Scheme which was opened up in Rhodesia before many of the others, before, for example, the Australian scheme. Most of my course, half of them were Australians. They came there to train. So that was my main interest in life. And I repeat, I walked out and decided that I was going to go and fight the war, contrary to the instructions of our government, and came to join the air training scheme. And from there, came over to England. Not to England, to the Western Desert. That's where we were first set up.
How did you alight on the RAF as a choice?
Well, we were part of the RAF. We were part of Britain.
As opposed to joining the army or in other words, how did you alight on...
I always wanted to fly. That was one of the great ambitions of my life, was to fly. So I didn't have to think twice about that. That was no change in my outlook.
And can you tell me something about the training that you undertook before you went to the Western Desert?
We had a wonderful training course at this Empire Air Training Scheme in Rello, in a place called Fort Hill. And it was absolutely the top of all the range. I think there were a few people who would disagree with me when I say that we had the best air training that you could get anywhere in this world. So from there on, I repeat, I went up to Egypt and spent a lot of time there. Eventually I was shot down in the western desert. But that's a different story.
But we'll come to that. How long did it take you before you qualified as pilot?
It took about 8 or 9 months. It's a very intensive course.
And did that training involve any air gunnery, or was it purely training you to fly?
Oh, it was mainly to fly, but we did also have air gunnery and air bombing. There was nothing that was left out. It was a very intensive course, and it covered everything.
And when you gained your wings, did you attempt to determine where you were sent, or were you just sent to the Western Desert and you said, thank you very much?
I think I was hoping that I would be sent to England, because that was where most of the fighting was taking place. I mean, the Battle of Britain, a lot of the Air Force flying people there. I think it was Winston Churchill's famous words when he said, never in the history of human nature has so much been owed by so many to so few. And he was referring to that Battle of Britain when we sheltered the people who were coming back from Britain because the Nazis had invaded France, took France over, and then they came into Holland and Denmark, and we had to make sure that we could hold our own. We did not want to let them cross the Channel. That was our main function.
Now, I seem to hear you saying a subtext here, possibly, that people you were with, your fellow Rhodesians, your fellow Africans, felt as British or more British than perhaps the British did themselves. Would that be true? And if it is, why do you think that was?
I don't think there is any doubt that we were more British than the British, and that's because we made an effort to come out there. Our forebears went there, following the course of Cecil John Rhodes, who wanted to build a red route from the Cape to Cairo. And that was his hope, that was his intention, to spread British influence right up through Africa. And we were part of the defense of the Gulf. Aden, we used to do a number of visits every year to Aden to liaise and to cooperate with the British Air Force there. So we were part of that scene. And I think when we eventually declared our UDI, that's a different story altogether. That Prime Minister of Britain was given the message from his chiefs of staff that any suggestion that British troops should be sent to take over Rhodesia were a non-starter, because his commanders had said to him they would not participate. That was Rhodesia. We were more British than the British. Our forebears went there because they believed in that. Had they not believed in that, they would probably have stayed at home in England.
Thank you. So you complete your training in Rhodesia, and you are posted to the Middle East. Can you tell me something about that? And then ultimately your Middle East service, please?
Well, we were posted to the Middle East. First of all, I did an air fire in an air gunnery course in a place called Baalbek, which is in the valley between Damascus and over the famous cedars of the Lebanon into the Mediterranean. It's interesting for me to think back on history now, because I have spent a lot of my time at a place called Kirkuk, and that's in the history a lot now, because there were big oil fields in Kirkuk, and we were put there to protect the oil fields and the pump line which went over the border, the Kirkuk and Mosul. Funnily enough, that was part of our system, part of our training. And I couldn't understand the business of flying over the so-called Dead Sea. And when I tell a lot of people that I flew over that and I was flying at 1,200 feet below sea level, A lot of them look at me and say, how stupid can this man be? How can you fly below sea level? Well, that we could do. That was the Dead Sea. So it was a tremendous experience, and I will always remember that. And especially with modern history, so much of it all comes back to me now. Damascus, I remember that so clearly.
What was Damascus like then? And can you just give me a date, please, Mr. Smith?
When that was in 1941.
So this is immediately after the Vichy French had been ejected, really, from Syria and the Lebanon.
Yes.
Because they were ejected in July 1941, so this would be late.
Shortly after that.
Shortly after.
And we were in Alexandria when the Italian fleet surrendered and came in and flew into Alexandria. The Italian fleet ships. But that, were there to meet them and bring them in.
But that would be 2 years later.
That was later.
Yes. Okay. Just tell me, what was Damascus like when you were there? Just after the French had left.
Well, I don't think it was any different from what we had originally expected, and similar to all the other places there. Damascus, Tehran. We started up in Tehran, which was part of
Iran.
Yes, part of Iran.
Persia, as it was then.
Persia, that's right. That was where we started. And I didn't detect any difference between all of those countries. They were all much the same to me. So that was our life. We got on and we did what we were supposed to do. We didn't ask any questions. I wasn't all that interested in history and the type of people who they were. We just wanted to know what was expected of us, and we got on to do it as efficiently as possible.
When you had finished your training in the in the Baalbek Valley, where did you go? What did you do?
We were posted for a little bit, as I have mentioned to you, at Kirkuk, guarding the pipeline when the fuel was going over into the Mediterranean. And then we went back to the Western Desert. We were stationed at El Alamein. And
this was before the battle, of course, the famous battle. This was early 42?
That's right. And I remember I was part of Montgomery's army, the 8th Army, which was set up to chase the Germans out of Egypt. That was, what, 42, 43, was it?
Yes.
And he created his 8th Army. But he also said, we've got to have airplanes. We've got to make sure that these German airplanes, the Ju-88s, the Stukas, the dive bombers, etc., we've got to have an air force to deal with them to make sure that we're going to be safe. So we were part of an organization called DAF, D-A-F, which is the Desert Air Force. And I've got a very nice tie. I haven't got it on. I'm not wearing it tonight, but I have one with me, a DAF tie, which is Montgomery's 8th Army badge with wings on the top, in order to ensure that he could get in and drive the Germans out of North Africa. And eventually, he succeeded in doing that and joining up with the Americans, who had then come in through the West Coast.
That's right. Tell me, so you were stationed at El Alamein in the early part of 1942. What were your duties? Did you engage the enemy at that time, or were they some distance away still? What was your squadron's function?
Our main function was to protect the Navy and the Army, who, as I have already mentioned, their plan was to drive the Germans out of Egypt. So they wanted protection from us, and that was what we were charged to do. And exactly what we did. And I'm pleased to say we were very successful in giving them the necessary protection and guard, so that eventually they got right through and joined up with the Americans.
And were you flying sorties every day, or was it infrequent?
I think nearly every day. We were flying most of the time. There were a few days when we were not flying.
And at this time, you were an ordinary fighter pilot. You were not a flight leader or anything like that. You were merely a fighter pilot, just a member of a squadron.
That's correct.
What rank did you have, Mr. Smith?
Well, to begin with, I was a pilot officer. And then you progress to become a flying officer. And then subsequently, when you take over the command of a flight, you become a flight lieutenant. That's what I was at the time when I was shot down during the war.
But in the desert, you were
a pilot officer.
How long were you in the desert for?
Well, altogether, we were there for 18 months, guarding and protecting the 8th Army as they were going up through Africa. And I think together, altogether, that amounted to about 18 months before we eventually joined up in the West with the Americans who had come in.
And presumably you participated in and flew in the air battles that were associated with Montgomery first stopping the Germans at Alamein and then the successful offensive that followed weeks later. Would that be right or not?
I think that is correct. That was our main function. We didn't have many battles with German airplanes because we were in the ascendancy. What we had to guard against was the... especially their Ju-88s, the Stukas, and a lot of their flying came at night time, because they wanted protection from our Spitfires and our Hurricanes. So that was what we did. We had to do most of our flying in guarding the troops as they went up.
And attacking German ground troops.
That's right.
And you did some of that?
Oh, yes. That continued all the time.
Harassing the German columns as they retreated.
Yes.
How long would you say that you were in the front line for? Did you, was the squadron pulled back from time to time to rest and refit? And did you suffer casualties? Did you suffer severe casualties or were casualties relatively light, if any?
No, I suffered some serious war casualties. At one stage I had a crash taking off in the middle of the night in a sandstorm. And I had a crash. And that was a serious incident. In fact, I thought I'd broken my back. But fortunately, it wasn't broken. But as doctors have said to me subsequently, when x-raying my system and looking at my back and other things, and I'm surprised at how many of them said to me, "My word, but you have got a bloody awful spine. Everything is all buckled and bent." That was my life.
When did the accident occur?
That occurred in about 42. But then subsequent to that, as I say, I was shot down flying from Corsica.
Well, we'll come to that.
All right.
Because after you then recover from your injuries, which will be the end of 42, early 43, I assume.
Yes.
When you had recovered from your injuries and you were fit to fly again, did you have to fight in order to get back on flying duties, or were they, or you know, was there any attempt to send you elsewhere to instruction or back to Rhodesia?
Yes, they did suggest that to me. I could go back home. Well, I said that's the last thing I want to do. Thanks very much, and I made it clear that I was staying there and carrying on with the fight.
And they accepted that. The authorities accepted that.
Well, they had no option.
Why? Excuse me. Why did they have no option to accept what a flying officer wanted to do?
Well, what else could they have done? If they'd suggested anything else, I would have just refused to do it and got on with it. No, I said, I'm going to stay with the boys here. I've been with all along, and we're going to go on fighting together. Who can argue against that?
When did you rejoin your squadron? And did you join the same squadron, or did you join another one?
No, I joined the same squadron.
Can you just tell me which one that was?
237, Rhodesia and Brackets Squadron.
So you were all Rhodesians,
yes,
or not?
Yes, that was a Rhodesian squadron.
And so the air crew were Rhodesian, or were the entire ground crew? In other words, was the entire...
Pretty well all Rhodesian. We had one or two other people in from the parts of the Commonwealth. we were pretty well ordered.
And this obviously was deliberate policy on the part of either the government of Rhodesia or...
Well, I think that was the policy of the government of Rhodesia, and it was welcomed by Britain. But the Rhodesian government said, this is our squadron, we're going to go on dividing people to see if we can continue to play our part in fighting the war against the Germans.
And you were flying Spitfires?
Yes. First of all, Hurricanes, and then we went on to Spitfires.
When did you change over to Spitfires?
We changed from Hurricanes to Spitfires about 43.
Oh, so the battle against, the fight against the Germans in the desert was conducted in Hurricanes?
Yes.
What did you think of the two aircraft, and how did you find them as a pilot?
They both had a part to play. In the Hurricane was slower, a little more sluggish than the Spitfire, but it was more manoeuvrable, could turn more easily. So I don't want to downgrade the Hurricane. It had an important part to play. But the Spitfire, they perfected it more and more, and it actually was the most perfect fighter pilot ever in the world, with its Supermarine Rolls-Royce engine, and its ability to go faster than the Hurricane. It was a wonderful plane. The Spitfire, I must say, that is the most perfect airplane I think ever made.
And a joy to fly from your point of view.
Beautiful to fly.
Was there any difficulty in moving over from one to the other? Did you have any conversion problems?
No.
So you rejoined 237. This would be sometime in the early part of 43.
Yes.
And they're about to convert then to Spitfires.
That is correct. And then they moved across to Naples, which is a transition camp, and then went across to Corsica. We were actually based in Corsica. And the reason was, Corsica was further north than the fighting line in Italy. So we took over Sardinia and Corsica. They had been taken over by the Americans and the Italians, because the Italians then abandoned the Germans and were coming onto our side. So we found that that was the best place from which to operate, because we could go over the Ligurian Alps into the Po Valley, over the top of Genoa and into the Ligurian Alps, in the bottom of the Po Valley.
So you were flying over over northern Italy then, weren't
you? That's correct, yes. That was where I was shot down.
A long way behind hundreds of miles behind where the lines were, which were right down at that time in southern Italy, below Rome.
That's right, yes. And we used Corsica because we was further north and we could get further over into the Po Valley.
Yes.
Where there were some big marshalling yards.
Yes. Well, just before we return to Corsica, you did say that you saw the Italian fleet arrive in Alexandria.
Yes.
Can you just describe that? Because that would have been before you went to Corsica.
Yes, I don't remember a great deal about it, other than the fact we were on the defence of Alexandria at the time. So we were told that the Italian fleet had surrendered and that they were coming in. So it was a little consequence to us. They didn't need much protection. But I remember seeing them coming into Alexandria just as a matter of interest, but there was nothing.
How many ships came in? Roughly?
I would be guessing. I should think it was about 7 or 8.
7 or 8. And did you ever meet or see any of the Italians? Were they dejected? Were they happy?
No, we never had any contact with them. Maybe the people on the ground did, but not us in the heavens.
Okay. So we'll take you to Corsica. Were you still, how should I put this, a plane flying officer, or had you become a flight commander by that stage?
Well, at that stage I was a flight commander. And I used to lead a flight of, most cases, of 6 aircraft.
Did you?
And that was what I was doing at the time when I was shot down in the Po Valley.
And what were you attempting to do when you were shot down?
We were strafing in a big marshalling yard. And there were large numbers of big steam engines. And one of the most pleasant sights you can have if you're strafing and you've got an aeroplane with 20 millimeter cannons on is to hit one of these planes and they just absolutely blow up in steam. And it's a tremendous sight. So that's what we were doing.
I see. How many operations did you undertake before you were shot down? Broadly, I don't want a precise figure. In other words, were you operating for many months before you were shot down?
Oh, yes. Many months. I was operating for a long time.
And were you operating most days?
Most days we operated, yes.
And can you tell me whether you had periods off or were you... Because what I'm thinking to myself is the stress and the strain of operating every day for months must have been almost overburdening, almost unendurable.
Well, we used to have weekends off. We used to go to Alexandria. We had a club there, a Rhodesian club. And we also had a Rhodesian club in Cairo. So
you used to fly from Corsica all the way back over to...
No. Talking about when we were in the Western Desert.
Oh, I'm sorry. But when you were in Corsica, you obviously had time off too.
Well, then we had time off. We just went back to Naples. That was our center.
Right. And I think it's correct, is it not, that at one point you went to the San Carlo Opera?
That's right. Enjoyed that very much. In fact, one of these occasions, I went and just advertised that the great Gili's daughter was singing. And she did sing, and they gave her a tremendous ovation and so on. But she had a long way to go to catch up with her father.
How many times did you go?
No. I didn't go more than a half a dozen times, I suppose.
Right. Well, I'll just interject, if I may, Mr. Smith, because I have interviewed the man who restored the San Carlo Theatre after it had been bombed, a man called Peter Francis, who is almost your exact contemporary. He's 86. And I met him last year, and he restored it to enable troops to go and enjoy not only opera, but, of course, theatre of every kind.
Yes, I find that interesting.
Well, when we've finished, I'll give you some details about him. Thank you. So, you continue to fly from Corsica. You're flying your Mark 9 Spitfires?
Yes.
And one day you ran out of luck.
That is correct. One day as I was leading the flight, I did what I'd always told people not to do. I went back for a second crack. You know, once you've stirred the hornet's nest, then you can expect that there are a few problems, and that's exactly what I did. And I then did a second attack, which I, again, should not have done. I repeat that. It was contrary to what I had always told my flight. But rightly or wrongly, it so happens that on that occasion, it was wrongly, I went back and I had a second crack, and I was hit by Akak guns.
What sort of speed did you fly in to attack marshalling the yards? Were you going fast or slow?
Yes, no, you always increased your speed to go down and attack. The sooner you went in, the sooner you were out of trouble, and that was what we were trying to do.
So these gunners were either quite good or quite lucky to hit a Spitfire going as fast as you were?
Well, when you arouse them, when you've woken them up, then they are all waiting for you with their guns pointing in your direction. And there are a number of them, so not surprising that one of them hit me. And I repeat, I did what I should not have done. That's a fact. I must concede that.
Right.
So then I had to get out. I said to my number two, you follow me, and the rest of you, the other four of my flight, I said, you carry on and you exercise, and when you've finished, then you fly back home to Corsica. But I thought if only I could get up and get over the mountains and over Genoa. Even if I could only get a few miles out, I was satisfied that I'd be safe because we had motor torpedo boats that were established in Corsica. They were always cruising around there, and if there was any chance of problems, they would have been there in a flash.
And pick you out of the water.
Yes. But I never made it, unfortunately. My number two, a fellow called Alan Douglas, who I got to know very well, he subsequently went to my old university and he became a chartered accountant. He was flying behind me. And he said, you know, I'm a bit worried about you because a lot of fire and smoke is coming out of your engine. And, well, I said, okay, just keep an eye on me and see how I go. But then before long, he said, no, it's getting worse, I'm afraid. It isn't just sparks and smoke. He said, it's beginning to catch on fire. Well, I don't want to appear arrogant, but I think I was a good pilot. In fact, I was the top scoring pilot on my squadron at that time and when this happened. So I had done my drill very well. And I knew exactly what I had to do. First thing I had to do was to jettison my canopy, get that out of the way. And once I'd done that, then I had to release shoulder straps on my harness because there are cases, so we are told, pilots who freeze